A town in Siberia recently soared to more than 100 degrees. According to the UN Weather Agency, the Arctic is heating at roughly twice the global average. What are the consequences of the Arctic's rising temperatures? Later in the show, we'll discuss a recent appeals court decision to uphold more than $2 billion in damages against Johnson & Johnson. The court said the company knew there was asbestos in its baby powder. The money will go to women who say their ovarian cancers were caused by the company's talcum product, including in its baby powder. Join us after the news. Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On June 20th, a small town in a remote region of Siberia hit the highest temperature ever documented in the Arctic Circle. The news made international headlines. On the first day of summer, the temperature in the north of the Arctic Circle soared to 100 degrees. According to climate scientists at the UN's Copernicus Climate Change Service, the majority of the Arctic could experience higher than normal temperatures through at least August. So what explains this? What does this mean for the future of the Arctic and the planet? To explore these issues, today we're joined by two guests. Greg Henry is professor in the Department of Geography at the University of British Columbia. He's been conducting research on Arctic tundra ecosystems for the past 30 years. He focuses on understanding the consequences of environmental change driven by the changing climate on Arctic tundra ecosystems through long-term observations and field experiments. Professor Henry's work, his team, also works in Arctic communities to help northern students understand and interpret observations of environmental change by elders through shared field and class experiences. Hi, Professor Henry. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hello there. Glad to be here.
Hi, great to have you. We are also joined by Dr. Ted Skambos, research scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center at the University of Colorado in Boulder. Dr. Skambos studies the effects of climate change in Antarctica. Among his research interests are climate change impacts on the polar regions, Antarctic history, geochemistry, and planetary science. Hi, Dr. Skambos. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you very much.
Well, it's great to have both of you. I just wonder what your overall opinions are, obviously based on the science, about what we just saw recently. This got international headlines. First, Professor Henry, were you surprised by the news that part of Siberia is recording extreme temperatures?
Yes and no. I mean, the frequency and magnitude of these extreme events is increasing, which is kind of predicted from the background climate warming that's going on in the north, which is twice the planetary average. And so the fact that it has happened, it's actually been happening. There's been extreme events, extreme warm events in other different parts of the Arctic, but especially in that eastern Siberian area for many years now. So the level of it and the magnitude of the warming this particular summer is amazing, but not it's kind of what we would expect given what's going on, and we can expect this to keep on happening is the major problem.
Dr. Skambos, what would you add?
Not much to add there. Yes, it's a surprise in terms of just how big the record is relative to recent years. But yes, Siberia has shown several of these warm spells in recent years, and it's a big concern. It's a big concern because there's a huge area of permafrost up there, and as I think we're about to discuss, that represents a big potential surge in the amount of greenhouse gases that might be released into the atmosphere.
Right. We've done some shows about this, about the ice thinning and melting, about permafrost thawing. In some cases, ice cover on the Arctic Ocean is about half what it was decades ago. According to some estimates, its thickness has shrunk by 40%. Professor Henry, if we can pull back a little bit and just talk about why what is happening in the Arctic is so important.
Well, one way to think of the Arctic is it's one of the two air conditioners for the planet. The other one at the other end of the South Pole. And what is important there is really the mirrors at both ends of the planet that allow solar radiation to be reflected off of the snow and ice. And one of the reasons that we're getting rapid warming twice the rate of the planetary average in the Arctic is because of the loss of the mirror. The mirror comes the snow and ice, especially the snow cover, is seasonal. So we have that on in the fall, a little later now. It comes off earlier in the spring, and then that allows the solar radiation to be warm, to be absorbed and then turned into heat, basically, by heating back up into the atmosphere for a much longer period. And so that warming and the loss of the mirror has both strong regional effects, which we're seeing in Siberia right now, and across the Arctic. I would mention that warming, warm air has moved around the Arctic, and we can come back to that. There's some record temperatures in the Canadian High Arctic right now. And so that effect in the Arctic actually has global effects, because we no longer have that the cooling effect of the albedo, and also the permafrost and ice up there that absorbs a lot of the heat, as well as the sea ice being part of that mirror, and the cold ocean, which warms up when you have sunlight on it rather than being reflected off the sea ice. So it's at a very important part of the climate system on the planet.
Dr. Skambos, what would you add?
Again, not a whole lot to add there, but I agree. It's the fact that the pole of the Earth reflects that sunlight and heat back into space that helps keep things in balance, not just the overall temperature of the Earth, but also the pattern of winds around the Arctic. And over time, as we lose the white snow and the white sea ice, we change how those winds are arranged around the North Pole, and it leads to unusual weather patterns sometimes, like we're seeing right now in northern Siberia. And the Earth reacts to this. The Earth is going to react by losing permafrost and by losing the snow cover earlier, as Dr. Henry said, and continuing to propagate changes that'll come down to where people live on the planet, a little bit lower in latitude through Europe and through North America. We'll see unusual weather patterns with increasing frequency.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to give out the phone number. If you have any questions for our guests about what's happening in the Arctic, it's warming twice as fast as other parts of the planet, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. So what explains that the Arctic is warming twice as fast as other parts of the planet? Professor Henry?
It's that albedo effect, the reflection, the reflectivity of the ice and snow and the sea ice. Mm-hmm. That's a major factor. There are other contributing factors, but it's mainly this albedo effect, the loss of the snow earlier in the spring, a loss of the white color, as Dr. Scampo said, on both the sea ice and in the glacier snow cover, going earlier in the spring and then coming on later in the fall. That allows the solar radiation to be absorbed by the darker ocean, by the tundra and the boreal forests, And it is about half of the warming comes from absorbing of that solar radiation on by the ground, and then it's re-emitted back up into the atmosphere. So that's the main effect. As I say, there's a few other factors, but it's largely the albedo effect.
Anything to add, Dr. Skambos?
No. again, that's why we've already been through it. Basically, the change in snow cover and the change in sea ice means that rather than just, here's the reason why. The fact is that the Arctic in the late spring and summer, it gets close to the melting point. And when you go from below freezing to above freezing and you have a lot of snow and ice around, it changes everything. First of all, even as you begin to melt, the snow gets darker. So it begins to absorb more heat and melt a little faster. But as we've been saying, once you remove that snow cover, the dark ground underneath it, with the dark ocean underneath the sea ice, absorbs heat by a factor of about 5 to 10 times as much as the original snow-covered surface. So if that's happening over a longer season, earlier in the spring and later in the fall before you get the white snow cover back on again, we're going to heat up that northern region more rapidly than the rest of the Earth. And it, as we've been saying, it has a lot of knock-on effects, both for temperature and for winds, and also on the permafrost, which is a big reservoir for more greenhouse gases. So it's a really terrible situation to have this begin to happen and therefore provide sort of an uncontrolled and uncontrollable greenhouse gas source going into the future. It's a bad deal because we can't keep the permafrost frozen if we keep warming the planet the way we are. Mm.
We have a question from Greg. He says, Peter Wadhams has said that catastrophic loss of tundra gases could heat the atmosphere by 0.5 to 1 degrees, essentially instantaneously, that is, in 1 to 2 years. How much effective temperature rise is locked up in the Arctic tundra? Who'd like to take that one?
If I may, I think it'd be kind of ridiculous to try to put an exact number on that because it'll be processed through the Earth's climate system, which is quite variable. In other words, yes, you can add the greenhouse gases, but instantaneously, I don't see how you would release them instantaneously. It would take decades. And of course, climate is variable. So to say that instantaneously temperatures would rise, I think it's easier to say that within a decade, climate would change. And it may go in several directions, but mostly on average warming.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for the email, Greg. If you'd like to email us or give us a call, if you have any questions about what's happening in the Arctic, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. What about Antarctica? Are you seeing similar changes there? And maybe if you can give us some information about the major differences, because often when I was reading for this story, a lot of the stories focus on the Arctic and Antarctica. Mm-hmm. So can you talk about the major differences before we dive in and talk about Antarctica, Dr. Skambos?
Well, Antarctica is a different situation. Not nearly as much of the southern continent gets close to the melting point. And I was emphasizing before that it's really that transition from frozen white landscape to melting or thawed and exposed land and ocean that causes a big knock-on effect for climate. Antarctica, even in summer, most of it remains well below freezing. The other general thing about Antarctica is that rather than in the global warming environment, rather than warming as most of the planet is, Antarctica is seeing a lot of variations in terms of wind patterns. A lot of this has to do with the fact that the rest of the planet is warming and there's a big circular ring of winds around the continent that has begun to blow a little bit faster. But still, the continent remains fairly isolated Now, the other big factor is that the Pacific has a lot of control over what happens to Antarctica. And when patterns of ocean temperature in the Pacific change, it changes where conditions are warming or cooling in some parts of Antarctica over the decades. And so recently there's actually been a paper, I think it's out today, that's talking about how the South Pole has begun to warm significantly. But in fact, it remains at minus 50 and about minus 20 right through the summer. So it's a different beast, Antarctica. Mostly it's responding to global warming by being more variable than it used to be.
We have an email from Amy in Portland, Oregon. She writes, can you please describe the relationship between an ice-free Arctic, methane, and food scarcity? For example, the inability of plants to adapt to higher temperatures and crop failures. Professor Henry, can you take that one first?
Sure. That's an interesting connection. The change in methane, which follows on a little bit for what Dr. Scampos was talking about earlier, that instantaneous change that people talk about is really a very low probability event of methyl hydrates that are held in some permafrost areas and in ocean sediments. There's some fear that they may come up and cause somewhat instantaneous change. That's such a low probability that we don't really have to worry too much about it. The slower change, and methane is part of this, is warming up of the tundra soils. About twice as much carbon is in the permafrost soils as is in the atmosphere now. And it's going to take a long time for that carbon to get up into the atmosphere. Over 100 years, I think the contribution is, one estimate's about 100 billion tons. We put about 40 billion tons in the atmosphere every year, so it's a slow but steady and will be an increasing amount of carbon. So that will contribute to greater warming of what's called a positive feedback, warming making it warmer. That slow rate of increase, of course, the major rate of increase is due to us burning fossil fuels, so we could slow that down. That would help. Plants that are responding to the warming, of course, they're flowering earlier, they're growing bigger, things that you would normally think of for plants that are growing in these cold environments. One of the things that I'm quite interested in is just how well they will be able to adapt literally, genetically, and evolve, whether they've got the ability to evolve and change with the rapidly changing temperatures. And there's not a lot of research out there, but some of my own group's research is showing that it looks like there might be some capacity for responses, for evolutionary responses. That is a good news story, but it's just a story. Just research is just starting to get into that now, so we're not really sure. The other option is, of course, that some of the species would move further north, and that's happening all over the world, trying to find new fit into their climate that they now have, and they're moving north to try to keep in that climate. It's not easy. Moving north means you're into other different situations, like the soils are different, for example, for plants. In terms of food security, yeah, there's a major issue for communities across the Arctic, because everything is rapidly changing. From the permafrost, if it's ice-rich permafrost, and the ice starts to melt as the permafrost thaws, then that solid ground starts to move. And so buildings shift, traveling area, roads start to buckle. And so just getting around on the infrastructure is taking a hit. The migration of food like caribou gets disrupted. Caribou herds across the north, most of the caribou herds across the north are undergoing dramatic declines in numbers, and we're not really sure why. It likely has something to do with climate change and development. And so communities are quite concerned that they're losing that kind of food supply. Crop failure is important in some of the northern parts of Canada. It's not a major issue yet, but with extreme events like we're seeing in Siberia, especially drought, that's obviously going to be a concern for northern crop areas. So I think, you know, there are a lot of concerns for all sorts of reasons for this rapidly warming area of the planet.
Dr. Skambos?
Well, yeah, I think there are big concerns. The gleaning of the Arctic as it warms up, that's a nice partial offset to some of the greenhouse-inducing gases that might be released by thawing permafrost. But yeah, in terms of food security, there are a lot of concerns about how this rapidly changing climate in the far north is going to impact how easy it is for people to do the sorts of traditional living off the land access to food that they live on for the course of the year. The system is upset and not behaving the way it used to behave, and the folks that live there recognize it, and they're concerned about, you know, what's happening. And since it's mostly out of their hands, they're making sure that we know that what we're doing is having an impact on them, and a potentially serious one.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about that. Professor Henry, is it true that about 4 million people live in the Arctic?
Yes, and most of them in Russia. Russia has the highest, largest density of folks in the north, largely because they have a lot of northern land. In Canada, it's about 120,000 across our northern areas, depending on where you put the southern boundary, of course, and similar numbers in Alaska, 50,000 in Greenland, for example. And so there are lots of folks involved and make that home, and it's been home for Indigenous people for thousands of years, and so they've got a wonderful background of knowledge on and are able to see these changes and have watched them having an effect on their lives for many years now. They're living through these extreme events, and it's having a major impact on how they're able to live their lives.
Yeah, I was just looking at a piece in National Geographic by Jennifer Kingsley. She said she's been traveling to communities all over the Arctic since 2015, and she quoted Carl Ole Christensen, who grew up with towers of ice floating past his living room window in Greenland. He says everything has changed in the last 30 years. She writes, those changes differ from place to place, but they affect northerners everywhere. Professor Henry, what strikes you about how people are responding, and then, you know, how they're planning to respond in the years to come?
Well, it starts with the elders noticing that things have changed, and Dr. Skambos sort of alluded to this. It's a new system for them. The elders talk about not being able to predict the weather. Like, they used to know what the seasons would be like. They knew what the variability in the weather would be for a particular season. They would know where to go for traveling. They would know the sea ice would be this thick and it'd be safe. The lake ice itself would also be thick enough. And that is now out the window. They can't make the same predictions. And so travel is itself a little bit more dangerous now, because they can't rely on their traditional knowledge of the areas. That said, it's not just climate change in these communities. It's also social conditions that have deteriorated and rapidly changed. And so they're trying to deal with changes in their social lives and trying to get enough. For example, we mentioned food security. That's a major issue in communities around the Arctic. So trying to deal with those social conditions as the climate is also changing and affecting things like food supply in both the oceans and on the land is hard. One thing that Inuit, for example, in Canada are very good at adapting. So there is some positive, if it's happening to a population that knows how to adapt, this is a population that knows how, has gone through lots of adaptation in the past. And so they're leaning pretty heavily on their traditional knowledge to help them adapt to this, to the changes. But the changes are amazing, really. It's happening so quickly for them up there.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. Greg Henry is professor in the Department of Geography at the University of British Columbia. Dr. Ted Skambos is senior research scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center at the University of Colorado in Boulder. This is Your Calls One Planet series. Today, we are talking about what is happening in the Arctic. What are the consequences of rising temperatures? We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls One Planet. I'm Rose Aguilar. And today we are talking about the Arctic heating at roughly twice the global average. If you have any questions or comments, we're going to stay on this issue for the next 10 minutes or so. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today we're joined by Greg Henry, professor in the Department of Geography at the University of British Columbia. He's been conducting research on Arctic tundra ecosystems for the past 30 years. Dr. Ted Skambos is senior research scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center at the University of Colorado in Boulder. He studies the effects of climate change in Antarctica. Dr. Skambos, we have another, well, it's a comment really about what is happening for the people who live in the Arctic. Charles writes, I was in a native Yupik village along the Alaskan Bering Sea coast for parts of the last two summers. Most winters, they don't have, it's about Alaska, the Bering Sea coast. Most winters don't have enough snow to use snow machines and snowmobiles. Instead of hunting seals from the edge of the shore ice in the spring, they have to take small aluminum boats out into dangerous flows of broken ice. Last summer, it was so warm that salmon were dying off due to lack of oxygen in the local river. So, Dr. Skambos, it's just changing so quickly for especially for the people who live in these places.
Yeah, that comment is a vivid example, a first-person experience with this food security problem that's present in the Arctic, all along that coastal area along the Arctic Ocean and the Bering Sea, because of the rapid change. There's been very little sea ice on the Bering Sea for the last few years, very little snow cover. It melts off early. It just changes access and safety for these traditional hunting practices, and they rely on that. It's hundreds of pounds of food that you might get from a successful fishing trip, but if it's not successful, well, then you're out 100 pounds of food, 100 pounds of sustenance for the rest of the summer. It's changing fast. It's not so much, I would say, that the Alaskan indigenous population or the other Arctic peoples are saying, stop it, make the world get colder, we don't want to change anything. They want, though, to be involved in discussions about how to address the changes up there, treat indigenous knowledge and awareness of their environment with equal weight as traditional Western methods of assessing climate and impacts on climate, and any sort of development taken in a slightly different direction. Any sort of development that goes on in the Arctic needs to include indigenous people and indigenous knowledge from the get-go, a co-production of both knowledge and development in the Arctic. This is what they've been lobbying for, and I think it's completely justified. And in fact, there's a lot to learn from folks that have lived in the area for thousands of years. They know that the system is changing, but they know details about how and why it's changing that we can't easily perceive from the lower 48 or from satellites.
Well, thank you for that email, Charles. We have a caller. Let's go to Ariel. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just have a few brief comments. The first thing is that our planet is, involved in giving us everything that we have, and it's alive. And it, when we think of our planet having a fever, we need to recognize it as the biggest health crisis of all time for us, such that we come together as one human family and address this beyond market forces, beyond our own misunderstandings or confusion, finding a way to come together beyond our differences. And then the last thing I want to say is that when I've heard the glaciers break and melt, I know for sure that they're living beings. I hear the groans of their cries. And we need to recognize that different life forms, different from us, also have the right to live and are alive, even if we don't understand them, even if they're bigger than us. And, of course, the indigenous people have known that for so long. But this is a public health crisis, and we're in a state of emergency.
Well, thank you for the call. You actually just reminded me of the amazing documentary called Chasing Ice, and it's about what's happening in the Arctic. They do some incredible, well, they take cameras out and just, they get this footage day after day after day, and you do see just incredible footage. So if you have a chance, be sure to watch that documentary. I just wonder, to her point, you know, when we talk about what is happening in the Arctic or Antarctica, you know, these are very distant places, but what happens there has major consequences. And it's easier to, you know, focus on things like massive fires in California, for example, or in the West, that people can see and experience up close. Now, even though we're in the middle of COVID, which is getting the majority of media attention, what happened in Siberia did get a lot of headlines. And I just wonder for both of you, Professor Henry, how do you bring this issue to the public and, you know, ensure that people know what's going on and get people to take some action?
It is difficult because people don't naturally think of or have been and experienced being in these remote places, especially Antarctica, as Dr. Scampos knows. It's very hard to get there, although lots of people take cruise ships down and have experienced it from the deck of a ship and have more experience that way. The best way is just to think of this Earth, as your caller was just saying, as one big system. And the Arctic, as we've said before, is a major part of this system in helping to cool it down through permafrost and the albedo effect and things that we've talked about before. And the major effect of one of the major effects that will happen, especially since most of the human population is along coastlines, is sea level rise from the melting ice on both ends of the Earth, especially Antarctica, but also Greenland and the small ice caps on the Canadian High Arctic and other places. And so there's a direct connection with the warming planet affecting a large portion of the human population that lives along the sea coast. So trying to make those connections is the main way that I try to make people realize that the Arctic is a very important part that we should pay attention to. Obviously, the indigenous communities and realizing, you know, noting that people actually live there that are trying to continue their lives under these extreme conditions that are getting more extreme is another way to make it more human, to give the message a more human take on what is going on up there. But it's really making those connections, I think, is the main way to make everyone realize that this is an important thing that we need to pay attention to. And of course, these extreme events like the fires in Siberia gets everybody's attention, and it should, for sure.
Right, right. What approach do you take, Dr. Scampos?
going back to something else or a different track that the last caller had, I kind of agree that having this happen to our planet, this it's led by the Arctic. There's a lot of impacts on lower latitudes, and there are impacts in Antarctica, although they're different. But what it's doing is showing us that because this is the one planet that we're going to get, that we need to pay attention and also treat it with cooperation around the globe. It's going to take all of us. One thing that I like to point out is that in 2007, the IPCC and Al Gore won the Nobel Prize, but they won the Nobel Prize for peace, and that's because addressing global climate change is likely to be the most unifying thing we can do for humanity over the course of the next century. It's the thing that's going to point out that we're in this boat together, and that solving this problem and continuing to manage the planet in the future is humanity's best hope, both for survival and for at least a reduction in conflict, if not peace. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Ted Skambos is Senior Research Scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center at the University of Colorado in Boulder. He studies the effects of climate change in Antarctica. Dr. Skambos, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Greg Henry is professor in the Department of Geography at the University of British Columbia. Professor Henry has been conducting research on Arctic tundra ecosystems for the past 30 years. Professor Henry, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Very glad to be here, and thank you.
Thank you. And you can read more about this issue at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a short break, we will discuss a recent appeals court decision to uphold more than $2 billion in damages against Johnson & Johnson. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call's One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about a recent appeals court decision to uphold more than $2 billion in damages against Johnson & Johnson. The court said the company knew there was asbestos in its products like baby powder. The money will go to women who say their ovarian cancers were caused by the company's talcum products. Joining us to talk about more is Isabel Chowdhury, Senior Policy Manager at the National Women's Health Network. Hi, Isabel. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, first off, can you give us a little bit of background? Tell us more about why this case and when this case was filed.
Yes. This case came out on Tuesday, and it was a result of a group of women, two women and their families, who had alleged that Johnson & Johnson's talcum baby powder product caused their ovarian cancer. The court awarded the plaintiffs, it was split into two awards, and so the ultimate $900 million to Johnson & Johnson subsidiary, and $715.9 million against Johnson & Johnson, Johnson & Johnson as the company. Johnson & Johnson has had suits against them for several years now. They have thousands of suits against them, so this was definitely a victory for many of the consumers who have been fighting this issue for years.
The court reduced the amount by about half. Initially, it was $4.69 billion in damages, and now it is $2 billion. But as you said, this is still a very important verdict, right?
Yes, definitely. Yes, the court did reverse some of the jury's award. The appeals court lowered it, and they applied the punitive damages to the amount that I had just mentioned. But this is definitely a victory. Their products have raised concerns for several years. Independent research groups had discovered traces of asbestos in their products. And then last year, they had recalled a big lot of their products. And then recently, last month in May, they announced that they are going to discontinue selling the talcum baby powder products in the U.S. and Canada, but then continue to sell these products abroad.
And to even add a little more context to this, in 2018, Reuters came out with a big investigation. They examined many documents, as well as depositions, trial testimony, And they show that from at least 1971 to the early 2000, Johnson & Johnson's raw talc and finished powders sometimes tested positive for small amounts of asbestos. And company executives, mine managers, science, doctors, and lawyers fretted over the problem and how to address it while failing to disclose it to regulators or the public. So Johnson & Johnson, according to what Reuters uncovered, has known about this problem since the 1970s. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I was cut off there, but I think I heard you correctly. So Johnson & Johnson have known about this issue since the late 1950s. Several of their documents and memos demonstrate that they were aware that their product had traces of asbestos, and we know that asbestos is a known carcinogen and causes cancer. And so this is public information, public knowledge. It's been recorded.
Right. And according to Reuters, the World Health Organization and other authorities recognize no safe level of exposure to asbestos. While most people exposed never develop cancer, for some, even small amounts are enough to trigger the disease years later. Just how small hasn't been established, but many plaintiffs allege that the amounts they inhaled when they dusted themselves with the tainted talcum powder were enough.
Yeah. So asbestos is a very dangerous, hazardous chemical, or it's a dangerous, hazardous substance. And even the tiniest particle of asbestos can cause cancer and illness and even death. And so this is a very serious matter. And for them to have known that their products were potentially hazardous, or there were trace amounts of this of asbestos in their products, should have caused for them to discontinue selling the talc powder products long ago.
And I'm sure a lot of listeners are saying, okay, so the company knew about this. Well, what about the government? And Reuters has another investigation that they filed in December of 2019, and I'll just read from part of it. At an invitation-only gathering late last year, U.S. regulators and their guests huddled at a hotel near Washington, D.C. to discuss the best way to detect cancer-causing asbestos in talc powders and cosmetics. The Asbestos and Talc Symposium was sponsored by the FDA, and it was dominated by the industry. Most of the 21 non-government participants had done work for talc companies, such as testing and serving as expert witnesses and consultants. And key sessions were led by witnesses for Johnson & Johnson in lawsuits alleging the company failed to warn customers that its baby powder was tainted with asbestos. This piece is called "The FDA Bowed to the Industry for Decades as Alarms Were Sounded Over Talc." What can you tell us just about, you know, the government's role in all of this?
Yeah, so I read that Reuters report last year, and it is a really very unfortunate issue. Currently, the Food and Drug Administration does not have the authority to recall or order manufacturers to recall products that are harmful, like Johnson & Johnson's talcum powder products. Really left to the companies to voluntarily make these decisions. And we've seen, based on the fact that of this issue for so long, that if we leave the decision to the manufacturer, then that they're not always going to take the best interests of consumers. They're not going to put consumers first. And so the government definitely needs to have more authority. And, you know, at the National Women's Health Network, we have been fighting to get legislation passed to provide the Food and Drug Administration with the ability to have the authority to order manufacturers to recall products like this when it's discovered that their products are harmful.
Right. The investigation found that over the past 50 years, the FDA has relied upon the industry, even as outside experts and citizens, people who buy these products, repeatedly raised serious health concerns about talc powders and cosmetics. How does the asbestos end up in products like baby powder?
Yeah, so when talc is mined, so when miners are, or people who are mining for the substance, when they mine the talc, it can be commingled with asbestos. And so it's very hard to separate asbestos from the talc substance during that process. And unfortunately, for years, for decades, companies have just used talc, and there's always a risk that, or there's often a risk that during that process of extracting the talc from the earth or from where it is mined, that it will be commingled with asbestos.
And talc is used in a lot of products, right? We're talking about blush, foundation, lipstick, eyeshadow.
Yeah, it's used in many cosmetic products and in makeup. It's used in many personal care products like baby powder. It's in cosmetics and personal care products. And there are safer alternatives like cornstarch. And even Johnson & Johnson has the same talc product or talc-based product in cornstarch. Or they have the same product, but with cornstarch as a replacement for talc. And so we do have alternatives that are more safe. So it's really frustrating that companies are still using a product that has so much risk. Or an ingredient, I should say, that has so much risk.
According to the New York Times, Mark Lanier, the lawyer who represented the plaintiffs, he's urging people to discard any baby powder they had in their homes. On May 19th, Johnson & Johnson said it would stop selling its baby powder talc in the United States and Canada, but it will continue to sell in several countries in Africa and Brazil?
So Johnson & Johnson's statement on May 19th stated that they will continue to sell these products abroad. In my research, I have found that there are several places where Johnson & Johnson has business segments as well as facilities, and those places happen to be countries in Africa, like South Africa, Ghana, and Kenya, and they also have Brazil is also home to all three of its business segments, which includes the consumer segment that sells its the talc-based powders.
And they heavily market this to Black and Brown people, right?
They do. They have, and you know, Reuters did a really excellent report outlining the really gross practices that they engaged in to market their products specifically to Black women, Latinx women, overweight women in Chicago, in the South. And so, yes, they have aggressively targeted and doubled down on targeting these communities.
And in our final minutes, as of March, the company faced more than 19,000 lawsuits. The company prevailed in some cases, lost in others. It's appealing nearly all of the cases it lost. We should also mention that according to the New York Times, some of the women have actually, sadly, six plaintiffs in the case passed away before the trial started. Five more women have died since the jury trial ended in 2018. And this is, again, according to the lawyer, Mark Lanier.
Yeah. So this is not a situation or an issue to be taken lightly. I think because the federal government does not have the authority to force manufacturers to discontinue selling these products, consumers are just often unaware that, you know, the products that are in the stores are not necessarily safe. And time again, you know, we have evidence, we have public record, and you can see people are, have actually died. There have been hearings about this with witnesses who have lost family members. And so this is a very serious matter, and it's just really unfortunate that we don't have legislation yet, and I'm very hopeful that it will, that legislation will be passed soon to at least provide the Food and Drug Administration the authority to take action against manufacturers who engage in practices and sell products that are very harmful and deadly.
Do you expect that other countries will also take action, especially countries in Africa and Brazil, where the company plans to still sell this product?
I do. We need to connect. When I say we, the U.S. needs to connect with, I think, global, you know, NGOs and governments to protect everyone worldwide from this issue. The European Union has done a good job at banning certain chemicals that are of issue. I'm looking forward to the work and the actions that will take place to prevent this from happening to women.
Well,
Isabel, especially historically marginalized communities.
Yeah, thank you. I'm sorry, your line is cutting in and out, but thank you so much for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Isabel Chowdhury is Senior Policy Manager at the National Women's Health Network. You can find out more about their work and about the Missouri Appeals Court ordering Johnson & Johnson to pay $2 billion in damages to women who said they developed ovarian cancer after using the company's talcum products contaminated with asbestos. This includes the iconic baby powder. You can also find the special reports from Reuters, and we are going to bring on those reporters in the coming months to talk more about those investigations. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for keeping our studio going. And I hope you can join us for tomorrow's show. We will speak with doctors about how the COVID pandemic has disproportionately impacted communities of color. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.